Hi, folks, and welcome to another exciting episode of IT Life Radio. IT Life Radio is the show for you, the IT pro, the technologist, the futurist, and the maker. Every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern, we cover a topic most important to your life, your IT life. I'm your host, Executive Editor Dave Wagner. Today, we're talking bossy bosses. Everyone has had the nightmare boss at some point in their lives. They yell at you. They have unrealistic expectations. They don't know how to manage people in their department or their department. And how do they get there, and what can we do about it? More importantly, what happens if you are the bossy boss? How do you get better? To help us all be better bosses and employees, we've got Gary Magenta. Gary is the Senior Vice President of Root, Inc., a consulting company that helps organizations execute their strategy through people. During his 14 years at Root, Gary has partnered with CEOs and executive teams at Fortune 500 and Global 2000 organizations throughout North America and Europe with a holistic view of their businesses, their people, and the customers they serve. Magenta is the author of The Unbossy Boss, 12 Questions to Make You a Better Manager. He's a frequent speaker at client events, industry conferences, and business strategy and human resources seminars. He's been recognized with a Stevie Award a Stevie American Business Award, for Executive of the Year. And he lives in Chicago, Illinois, at Fort Myers Beach, Florida, with his wife and has two sons in college. Gary is a Google fanatic and an unapologetic reality show junkie. Welcome, Gary.
Dave, thank you for having me.
Oh, well, we're happy to have you here, and we will get to that reality show junkie part very shortly. Very intrigued. But before we get there, what I'd really like to do is start where your book starts. Your book opens with a great story about you taking a job and moving across the country, I think to Chicago, if memory serves, and you realized on the very first day, and maybe even before your first day, that it was probably a really bad idea. Would you mind telling me that story?
I'm sorry, the move to Chicago?
I think it was Chicago. I could be wrong about the place, but
thank you.
The story
sorry.
Your book
opens. Yeah, you just broke up a second. Fine, great.
Oh, I'm
thank
sorry
you.
About
so,
that.
It's all right. Here's where it all starts for me, Dave, in this world of thinking about managers. You know, I had actually graduated from college and moved directly into being an entrepreneur. It's all I knew. You know, my parents and my grandparents, in fact, every generation on both sides of my family were entrepreneurs. They all worked for themselves. And so, of course, when I was going out into the world, I thought, well, that's what you do. And I did in my early 20s open up my own business and ran it for 9 years until it was purchased by a much larger company. And I was excited about the purchase. It was a validation of good work. It also, in my early 30s, did not leave me the luxury of being able to retire. I had to go to work still. And so I immediately found a job with a company in Chicago, and I was living in Florida at the time. And this company wooed me, and they liked my talents, and they really thought I could help them make a difference, and they sold me on all of the great things they were doing. And I met with the person that would become my boss during the interview process, and he was charming, and he was affable and knowledgeable and energetic and enthusiastic. And I will tell you, I could not have been more excited at 33 years old to start my first corporate position and have my first manager. And over a 4th of July weekend, my wife and I and our then two toddlers moved across the country during that long weekend so we could get settled in our new house, and at Tuesday morning or Monday morning, whatever it was, I could walk into my boss's office raring to go, having the family all settled, ready for the new job. And I did just that. I walked into his office on that first day, and I said, "Ken, I am so excited to be here." And he looked up from his desk, and he said to me, "What are you doing here?"
Oh, jeez.
That was his first
that had
comment.
To be deflating.
"What are you doing here?" And I tilted my head, and I said, I work here, I hope." And he said, "Is today your first day? Because I had no idea you were coming. Matter of fact, I don't have a desk for you or anything. Well, you know, go out and see my secretary," as he said, "and she'll get you set up." I thought, okay, well, you know, this is just some sort of a miscommunication between HR, and it'll all work out. And later on, he invited me back into his office that day, and he said to me, "What did we agree to pay you? Well, that's not right. That's more than the other people in the department. That's going to be weird." And that was my second encounter with him. And while I didn't budge on the money they had promised to pay me, it did sort of set the tone for my first day of working for someone new and what it meant to be onboarded in this instance. Well, in the weeks, days, months that followed, I started to get familiar with what my role was and how I was going to bring it to life, but that was really by trial and error. You see, there was no interaction, Dave, between me and my boss. There was no check-in on a personal or professional level like, "Hey, how are the kids doing getting adjusted to the new house?" Or, "Hey, did your wife find a job yet?" Or, "Hey, how's the commute?" There was nothing on a personal level, and there was nothing professionally in the way of questions about how's it going and what are you finding success in and where are the struggles, or let me give you feedback. In fact, I started to wait outside his door just to get a minute with him. I literally followed the man into the men's room or out to his car at night, seeking just a morsel of feedback, a conversation, the ability to bounce an idea, dare I say, get some coaching. And what happened was that one day I needed to really confront him and just said to him, "Ken, this can't continue. I need you to engage me in the business. I need feedback. I need some direction." And he said, "Well, it's a little late for that. After 20 years with the company, I've just given my notice. I'm leaving in 2 weeks." And so lots of fun, right? At the end of that conversation, as I looked at his car, I followed him to the parking lot that night, as I watched his car sort of go off into the sunset, I realized then and there, this guy was a terrific individual contributor and a great human being, great personality, but he was a horrible manager of people. And it caused me to start to reflect, how was I as a manager and owner of my own business? I had 55 employees when I sold my business. And I looked back as a young person in business, as a new manager of people, and realized I was every bit as bad as Ken, if not worse, during my time. And I understood in an instant the impact that I must have had on people and the impact that my new manager had had on me. And it really became almost my mission from that point on to understand what management means and how I could be a better manager and potentially develop managers. And fortunately, over the last 15 years, I've had the time and the place at Root to develop that point of view and do that research. So that's a little bit about how I got interested in the whole idea of what makes a good manager and my first experience with one.
Well, that's a fantastic story, and I think it gives us so many places to talk about this topic. Before I do that, though, I just want to let everybody know that we're going to do something a little different today. In the past, what we have done is we've asked people to do a 30-minute interview followed by a 30-minute text chat. Today, we're going to do an all-live interview, probably about 40, 45 minutes, because Gary thinks, and I agree with him, that this is the kind of topic that really helps if we hear each other talking live. There's a lot to be done here about inflection, emotion, stories. So what I'm going to ask everybody to do is I still want you to participate in that text chat, just like you always do. But when you ask a question for Gary, go ahead and put it in the text chat, and we're going to try to answer them live on the air. So please, for the next 40 minutes or so, pepper Gary away with fantastic questions. In the meantime, I'm going to pepper him away with the mediocre questions I always ask. So, Gary, one of the things about that story that's fascinating to me is that you realized you had been doing the same thing all of this time. I think a lot of managers don't have that moment where they realize that they have been as much a part of the problem as anything. How do you help managers sort of get a clear idea of who they are as a manager and where their strengths and their weaknesses lie?
You know, I think we have to start by helping managers understand what the job is, what the role is. So I start really by asking, why do people get promoted to manager in the first place? So if anybody on chat wants to respond to this, or Dave, if you want to respond to it, let's start with, why do you think managers get promoted in the first place?
Well, I tend to think, and we'll see what the audience says, but I tend to think they usually get promoted because they're good individual performers.
Right. So that is what I have found as well, that most organizations want to, and rightfully so, want to reward great individual performers. And so the way business structure is set up today is, well, you reward them by giving them people to manage. And when you think about this, one day you're an individual contributor, which means you're required to bring the best of yourself to work every day. And the next day, you're a manager of people, which requires you to bring out the best in others. And there's a huge skill gap between those two. And businesses make very little investment in helping individuals moving from individual contributor to manager to build those management skills. And those skills are polar opposite of one another, and yet there's no training. And somehow leaders in organizations think, if I just give you a name badge that says manager, through osmosis, you'll get that information, you'll get that skill. So it never happens that way. And so I think to answer your question directly is, we start by helping managers understand their role is to be the chief engagement officer of their teams, not to be the highest performing individual contributor on that team. We help them understand that they're the CEO of that team. And as the chief engagement officer, their job of manager isn't really to manage. It's to coach. You see, there's a big difference between the two. Management really talks about directing others, almost controlling the actions and the outcomes. And especially in today's business environment, that just doesn't work anymore. It's yesterday's view of management. Today, in order to be successful as a manager, you need to be a great coach, and that requires building new skills.
Right, and I see that, and I agree with you. But I think when people think of coaching, they sadly think of watching NFL coaches yell on the sidelines at their players. And
with a whistle.
Literally on the side of the head and blow their whistle and yell. What does coaching mean to you?
Yeah, so think about it this way. It's a great question, Dave. Coaching really, and let's talk about the difference between managing and coaching. Managing is about telling someone what to do, almost standing above them or across from them. Think of it visually as finger pointing. Hey, you need to do this. That's what a manager does. What a coach does is stand next to you as a partner. And instead of telling you what to do, speaks about outcomes and asks powerful questions. Coaches really know that their job is understanding the perspective of an employee, just to see at first, even if they're aligned on the task ahead. They really, as a coach, seek to understand those current realities of an individual contributor and drive, kickstart, if you will, any shifts in actions or behaviors that individual contributor needs to make to be successful. In other words, they're a partner in designing the actions and behaviors required to be successful in a job versus telling somebody to get something done.
Right. So I see that. I see how if somebody says, what do you think, or how would you get this done, that makes them a partner. I see that. I see how that can be engaging. But realistically, if the manager is just asking the question to get the answer they want, isn't that manipulation? Or what's different between manipulation and coaching?
Yeah, I don't think you're at your – so it's a great question, and it's a frequent question. You're not asking the question to get the answer you want. You're asking the question to gain understanding of the perspective of the person you're working with. If that perspective doesn't align with what you're thinking or where the company wants to go, there's a few opportunities there. One is there's an opportunity to rethink it yourself and say, oh, does this individual contributor, does this employee have a different way for us to think? Let's pause and reconsider. And in many instances, it's, oh, I understand the way you're thinking about this now. My job is to help you shift that thinking. And so I look at it very much like sailors in the 1400s, right? So if you're a sailor pre-Columbus and you believe the earth is flat, that's your perspective, you play very small. You only go around the waters in a very conservative way because you're afraid to fall over the edge. Think what Columbus and people in his time had to do was understand that perspective and help people understand a new set of possibilities. Because when you can coach somebody to a new set of possibilities or a new understanding, the world opens up in a very different way. You start to sail around much freer. So it's not, I want you to give the answer I want. It's not manipulation. It's creating broader understanding to help somebody change their assessments.
Right. Well, that sounds like it requires an awful lot of trust. Trust in your employees, trust in the fact that the world really isn't flat, trust that you have your own internal skills to ask the right questions. So in a lot of ways, that gets us back to that problem with unprepared managers. And one of our commenters said something that I think is quite spot on. She says, why do people get promoted? Well, they get promoted because they perform their tasks well. But that doesn't translate to managing people because tasks are not human.
Humans.
And that makes perfect sense to me. So where do we get the management trust and the management skills to go from performing tasks to humans? What should enterprises be doing to start lifting their managers up to get those kinds of skills?
Yeah, thank you for that, because this is something I'm very passionate about. When you think about the shadow of leadership or the power of a manager, it's a multiplier effect, right? You know, a manager may have 10, 15, 8, 5, pick the number, employees underneath him, but each one of those people underneath that manager are touching an internal or external customer. So if I'm a manager with 8 employees and each one of them touch 10 customers a day, that's 80 a day, times 165 touch points a year, I can't do that math, but it's a lot. And we know that individual contributors will really learn from their managers how to act, how to behave. And we want to make sure that managers are setting the right example, not only for their employees, but they're setting the right example for their employee to take to the marketplace. So with all of that said, let me answer your question specifically. Managers today in large numbers do not have the skills, and it's not their fault. Organizations today expect that if someone has the tenure as an individual contributor or has delivered results as an individual contributor, somehow that automatically makes them great at engaging people, and it doesn't. So the tie that we're trying to make, that I'm on a mission to make, is to help organizations understand the multiplier effect that their manager has internally and in the marketplace. Awaken them to that so that they'll make the investment in building managers' skills. This is an investment. It's an investment of time and money by organizations. It's also an investment by managers in themselves. And the reality is, Dave, that not all people with a manager title really want to be managers. They only see it as a way to get to the next level in their career. So they accept it. There are so many people that love being an individual contributor and they find power and strength and satisfaction in it, but they want or need more money, so they accept a manager position. We have to, in organizations today, do a few things. We have to invest in building the skill of managers who want to be managers, and we have to find ways to recognize the individual contributor who doesn't want to be a manager or will never really embrace the skills that it takes to be a manager. We have to reward them in a different way.
Right. I think that's a problem we really see in IT a lot. We've been having a lot of discussion recently on Information Week about soft skills and how to reward people in a different way, because we get these engineers who are brilliant network engineers or brilliant cloud engineers or whatever, and they really belong wearing a T-shirt and getting their hands dirty. But they stop being able to make more money, and they stop being treated like the heroes that they really are. And so they go into management and they fail because they're not people. They're cloud people or network people, and that's okay. But that's a real problem, obviously, for IT departments. You've worked with a lot of different companies and people. Have you seen ways of rewarding those people that are different? Are there, other than maybe giving them more money, are there other ways to reward those heroes that shouldn't be managers?
Well, first let me say, what's wrong with giving them more money is one of the questions that I ask.
Yeah, nothing's wrong with giving them more money from the point of view of everyone, I think, but the CFO.
Well, so this is interesting because, you know, there are companies out there who have really had success stories in giving people more money as individual contributors. And I think when I think of the Container Store, they're a really good example. And for your listeners, you can look online for the Container Store's philosophy around this. But in short, and I work with clients on this as well, where we make this recommendation, when you have a individual contributor who delivers 2 and 3 times the amount of their closest colleague, pay them for it. And they don't want to be a manager, pay them for it. And Container Store does that. I have some clients who are now starting to do that. If your employee can do 3 times the amount of work and you pay them twice as much, everybody wins. We are a business today stuck, mired in this everybody's equal. Everybody's not equal. Some individual contributors have such a capacity that they can deliver 2 and 3 times, and we say, great, you're a manager. In many of those instances, that person does not aspire to be a manager, but again, as I said before, only takes the job because it's the only way to get promoted. What's wrong with saying, we're going to pay you based on performance? What's wrong with saying, you do the work of 3 people, let's pay you at least twice as much?
Right. And that makes a lot of sense to me. But is part of the problem there that we don't have as easy way to measure work in some environments as others? Or am I just giving an excuse to enterprises who just don't want to pay good workers?
So here's what I think. I think it's an excuse, if I can be honest. Here's what I think the issue is. And I say I think because I don't have data to back it up. I think the issue is we are in a world today where organizations are very big. Distributed business models are very common in how businesses run. We're international, et cetera. And exceptions and one-offs are difficult. Being able to say you're a level one and all level one people make between X and Y, and the way we determine the variation is through your manager, is effective when you're running an organization of 100 people or 100,000 people. Empowering your people to make decisions, empowering managers to make decisions based on individuals is fraught with problems. You know, what if there's nepotism? What if there's favoritism? What if we're not evaluating correctly? All of those questions come up. the reality is that in organizations, there are bright spots, there are superstars, and the onus is on business today to figure out how to recognize them, because the fight for talent is back. If you're not compensating them as an individual contributor for the work they're doing, somebody else will, that's for sure now. And if you're only looking at giving them a manager position, millennials are saying, a lot of them are saying, we don't want that responsibility. We want to be great at what we do, and we want to do that as an individual contributor. I think that between the millennials and the aging workforce, those people are now in their 60s and saying, I still want to work, but I don't want the responsibility of direct reports, are both going to push business today to say, you need to recognize us for superior individual contributions without having to be managers. And at the same time, as our managers are graying and moving out, we have to take this next crop of managers and say to them, we're going to invest in you in a very different way. We're going to allow you to partner with your direct reports as opposed to boss them.
Right. Well, that makes me happy as a Gen Xer that everybody older and younger than me doesn't want to be a manager, because I'd like to be a manager. on a serious note, there was something you said a fairly long time ago in this conversation that I'd like to get back to. But before I get back to it, I do want to say that there are a couple of questions that have come up in the audience chat, and I promise I'm going to get to them. I want to ask one more selfish question of my own first, and then I'm gonna start asking Gary some questions from the audience. If you have a question, feel free to put it in there, because we're definitely going to get to some of your questions with Gary. But Gary, you said something I think two questions ago that I wanted to get to, which is that you said managers teach or set the tone for, I'm not sure what your language was, for their workers and how to act and how to behave.
Yeah.
And this is clearly true in my mind. And it gets to something that I've been thinking about for the last few weeks, and I noticed that you're thinking about it too, which is that we talk a lot on Information Week about the talent gap, and there is a talent gap out there. But there's also a management gap out there. I'm wondering if you think there's a relationship between the management gap and the talent gap, that if we had better managers, we would look around at some of the employees we have and realize that they're a lot more talented than we realize.
Yeah, it goes back to the multiplier effect. Bringing out the manager's responsibility is to bring out the best in others. That's finding their passions, finding their talents, and maximizing it. Let me answer your question directly. Yes, there is a significant correlation between the two. Your manager's responsibility, again, is to really highlight that talent and bring it to the forefront. If a manager is only focused on himself or herself, they're not doing that. Or if a manager is just focused on, the business but not the people, they're not able to develop the talent necessary. And this is a huge problem. I have this this survey I do with some leaders. Survey's the wrong word. It may be like a questionnaire, we can call it, where I just help I help them to understand where they currently spend their time, and helps me understand where they spend their time before I coach them. And the majority of these surveys or questionnaires come back, and spending time with their direct reports almost always comes in last. And I look at them and I think, as a CEO or a VP or a manager or supervisor, your main responsibility is your people. How is it that you're spending the least amount of your time focused on people?
Right. Right.
So,
I mean, how can you succeed if you're not talking to your own team?
Yeah, it's being an octopus with no arms. I mean, the role of a manager really is to be able to have as many tentacles as possible, to be able to do the work of the business, And it's, to me, a manager without spending time, most of their time on their direct reports, is really, not only aren't they maximizing the contribution of those individuals, they're minimizing the contribution to the business by their team or department.
Right. And this, you mentioned a multiplier effect in another way, but I think this seems to, in my mind, create a multiplier effect in another way, which is that we're pulling our managers from a pool of people, and some of those managers are succeeding and some of those managers are failing, basically by luck, because we're not giving them enough resources. Then we're pulling our upper management from that pool of management.
That's correct.
And then we're not giving them resources there.
Oh,
and then we're going all the way up to the CEO that way.
So it is amazing to me how many CEOs that we meet with in our work, and this is not a slight on any of them, where you realize, wow, there's a big skill gap when it comes to people, when it comes to engaging your other leaders to drive a business strategy or drive a result. There's a huge gap. And you recognize that at every touch point, at every milestone, I should say, along the way, someone has said, you're a great performer, we don't care what your people skills are, advance two steps ahead. Collect $200, advance pass, go, even though you're missing this key skill. Now, at some point, you get promoted to a level of incompetence, because the higher you go, the less direct influence you have on the business, and the more influence, and the more you have to use others to create change or to deploy strategy or to activate an initiative. You know, as I say, I was working with a CEO of a large retailer recently, and I said to him, how many customers have you waited on in a store lately? And he said to me, none. Why? And I said, that's my point. You're complaining about your customer experience. You don't wait on any customers. If you did, each one of those customers would be waited on brilliantly. But now you're relying on your managers to set that example for their front line, so the front line can bring that customer experience to life. That CEO is helpless when it comes to customer experience. Their manager, however, is not helpless. Their manager could drive great results if they were setting the right examples, if they were meeting with their employees to better understand the actions and behaviors necessary to deliver that experience. So, yes, we are promoting people to manager when they're missing certain skills, then we're not investing in them. So I'll give you the data on this. This I can tell you. 20% of people who are promoted to managers naturally have the skill to coach and engage. It's inherent. It's in them. And 20% are so absolutely bad at it, they'll never get it. There is this 60, they're just not wired that way. But the 60% in the middle need help. The 20% are already there, great, check the box. The 20% who can never get there, thank you very much, let's promote you to customer or to another role. The 60% in the middle can get there, and I think that's one of the questions we have online.
I was just gonna get to that.
Yeah, so to answer the question we have on here, does that mean that people can't be trained? Of course they can. About 60% of your workforce of managers can build the skills necessary to be successful as a manager. There's an opportunity in there.
That seems like a big number, because you're saying that basically 8 out of 10 people in my organization have the ability to rise to higher levels, and that sounds very optimistic.
Let's qualify it, Dave. You're 100% right. 8 out of 10 have the ability. In my book, I have something called a coachability spectrum, right? And it talks about why can some people be coached to a higher level of success and why others can't. And there's one very big factor past ability or capability that really determines whether or not that person will make it, because clearly organizations are not performing at the 80% level even when they do invest. The biggest determinant of success for someone to move from bad manager, if we can just say call it that, bad manager to great manager is desire. Do I have the desire, and how strong is that desire? Lots of people just don't have the desire to do it. Again, I'm in this job because I like the title, and my brother-in-law is a manager, so now we can sit at the Thanksgiving table and both be managers, so I like the prestige. Or my family, or me, myself, needs this additional boost of income, so I'll take this job. Those are the big reasons why people who have no desire to be a manager take the position or apply for the position. So if I lack the desire for the role, that will determine my success. And there's a lot of people that lack the desire. And they lack the desire to do the work. It's hard work to be a great coach, to be a great manager.
Wow. So how, I mean, that's fascinating to me, because I would have guessed it had something to do with intelligence or communication skills or something like that. How does a company measure desire?
Well, now you're getting above my pay grade, Dave.
Okay, well, fair enough.
I don't know how the company measures desire, but I do know that when you're coaching somebody, it's really part of the learning as a coach. What's this person's desire for change? And when you're coaching someone, it is a powerful question to ask. Really,
yes,
to gain that understanding. Yeah, it's one of those. Could be one of those watershed aha moments for both the employee and the manager. In this case, it may be the manager and his or her regional manager or vice president, et cetera. Really, what is your desire for this type of role and responsibility? How important is this to you outside of money and prestige? What does success look like for you if you do this role well?
Right. It gives me more respect for that job interview question I never liked, the where do you see yourself in 5 years? It actually makes a lot of sense that if somebody says, you know, I want your job after you're promoted or something like that, that sounds like somebody who's got the desire to do something. that question always seemed more threatening than maybe it is. Maybe it's a useful question.
That could be a useful question. I think it can be a useful question to find out, does somebody want to be potentially, let's just say, a researcher who gets to work from home in isolation, really getting great immense satisfaction out of uncovering trends, for example. For me, that to me sounds like a jail sentence. If I get great satisfaction by working with and through others, if I get great satisfaction by helping other people achieve their goals and achieve the goals of the company, then it makes sense for me to want to be a manager. And that's, I think,
right,
all that's behind that question. Success in 5 years for me looks like I'm working with a team to achieve goals, and I'm helping lead and inspire and mentor that team. Those are all ways to identify, is this person management material or are they individual contributor material?
Right. Well, speaking of questions, your book is called 12 Powerful Questions. Well, The Unbossy Boss, 12 Powerful Questions to Make You a Better Manager. I know you don't want to give away all 12 because we want everybody to buy the book.
Yeah,
and I recommend.
No. It's boring to list 12 questions.
True.
But we can talk about them in three buckets, Dave.
Yeah, let's do that, because I think that there are some very powerful questions there, and I do highly recommend, by the way, buying this book. I put it on my list of 12 books every CIO should read just about a month ago, and I do think that it belongs there. So tell me a couple of these questions or the buckets, as you said.
Yeah. So think about the questions, Dave, and the audience, in three major buckets, and you can look at the acronym ASK, A-S-K, ASK. So it's about asking powerful questions, and when you look at ASK, the A stands for asking questions that help align on the topic for the conversation. So let's make sure we're talking about the same thing, and I'll give you an example. If you sit down with an employee and you say, I want to talk to you about Bear. I want to talk to you about Bear, or let's talk about Bear. You think you're talking about the grizzly, and they think you're talking about aspirin. We're not aligned. So I give a list of questions that really help align on the topic for the actual conversation. And then when you get to the S part, that stands for seek. Seek to understand current realities. So I'll give you one from this morning. I live in downtown Chicago, as you know, with my wife, and I'm getting dressed to walk to work, and she's getting dressed to walk to yoga, and I'm excited because it's 48 degrees out, and I love a little bit of a nip in the air, and I'm going to go out with no jacket. So I think it's a beautiful day. She turns to me before I leave, and she says to me, "This weather is miserable." Well, if we were looking at seek to understand, when we're just talking about simple things like the weather, at 48 degrees and a little overcast, it's my perfect day to walk 30 minutes to work, and she thinks that she wants to leave the state, flee the state. So let's understand the current realities or perspectives about somebody else, because they may be very different than ours. So we have a list of questions that help you to seek to understand their perspective or current realities of the other person. And then finally, the K stands for kickstart shifts that drive action. So before we talked about helping sailors in Christopher Columbus's day to shift from believing the world was flat to seeing the world as round, so they would change their actions from I'm not leaving the harbor to I'm discovering new lands. And so there's a list of questions that help to shift people's perspective or know that it's not possible to shift for them at that time, but to shift their perspective from current thinking to a different thinking that can aid their performance and the performance of the business. So what's interesting is you can't just ask any question. There are powerful questions. And in the book, I give you 12 to sort of start, but they have to be yours. They have to be genuine. So I think even more important in the book is that I give people a guide to help them ask their own powerful questions. And it's actually part of the workbook portion. But what it says is that a powerful question is open-ended. It's non-judgmental. It's provocative, and it's respectful. And if you do those four things, ask open-ended questions that are non-judgmental, provocative, and respectful, you will indeed be able to create your own powerful questions. So I offer a little bit of a guide to help people do it in the book for themselves. But I want to give you an example, if it's okay, Dave, if we have the time.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
The example on how to build a powerful question starts with, let's take a scenario. You're in a hotel and there's a manager and a front desk clerk. And the manager says to the front desk clerk, "Do you see what you did wrong with that guest?" Well, that's not open-ended because it's really yes or no answer. Is it respectful? Not really. Is it provocative? No, it doesn't elicit a provocative conversation. It's basically just judgmental and shuts down. So it's not non-judgmental. So you can change that question. There's a better version that says, "How can you do a better job with that guest next time?" Well, that's open-ended. It is respectful and it is provocative, but it is also judgmental, and you don't want to be judgmental because that person could have thought they did a great job, and you want to know what their thinking is. So finally, we get to what's the best way to ask this question as a manager. As a manager, you can say, "What did you notice about the interaction with that customer or guest?" What did you notice about that interaction is open-ended, respectful, provocative, and non-judgmental. And through that question, you start to understand that employee's realities. And I find when you ask a question that is a powerful question, people get very honest very quick, because what shuts down honesty is defensiveness. When you ask a question that's not powerful, it puts people into defense mode.
Right.
Our job as managers is to create a safe environment where people can speak the truth and not feel like they're going to get in trouble.
Right. Well, that really does seem transformative to me. Though I think some employees would maybe consider that a sort of a trap, but I guess the less you trap them with the question, the more trusting they get.
Well, that's because there's not. If they do, Dave, my opinion is that there hasn't been trust built. If you're afraid that your boss is trying to trap you into a question, you are likely not in a trusting relationship with your boss.
Right. Right. Well, unfortunately, we're getting really close to the end of our time here, but I want to ask you two more questions, if you don't mind,
sure,
before we wrap up. And the first one is, I think everything you're talking about with these questions makes total sense, and I think they can be really transformative. But I suspect that some people are listening to that and going, wow, that sounds like it's going to take a lot of time. That's going to be I don't have enough time to do my job as it is. How am I going to talk to all my team and ask them all these questions and sit and talk when we have work to do? So how do you tell them? How do you show? I hate to use the term ROI, but I think that's how they're going to think. How do you show ROI in all of this question asking?
Yeah. So first, let me dispel the myth that this takes more time. Let's start there, because maybe we don't even have to answer the ROI question, but let's dispel the myth that it takes time. How many times are you engaged with a coworker or an employee walking down the hall, going out to lunch, getting out to the parking lot, walking to the restroom? Those are all coaching opportunities. Coaching or managing is formal and informal. So do you sit down once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month, depending on your organization and the level of employee? Sure you do. I don't suggest you change that at all, except just make sure you're doing it. But the informal is actually more important, and that happens oftentimes in the moment, through an email, on the phone, and a walk down the hall. So let's not think about this as adding more time to your schedule. Let's think about how you're spending time together and using every interaction as a coaching or mentoring opportunity. Where it adds more time is if you're currently not meeting with your employees in any way, shape, or form. And that, I'd say, you're not a manager. Give up the title or change your perspective. Those are your two choices. Give up the job if you're not meeting with them. If you are meeting with them, your number one job, if you're not meeting with them, understand your number one job is to be the chief engagement officer. And if you are meeting with them already, keep that meeting, just make it more productive by focusing on coaching and asking the right questions.
Great. Well, that makes sense. I hope it makes sense to managers listening, because I really think I think it would actually make your life easier if you had a better relationship with your employees, and it would make
everything goes faster, and your results do pay off. Everything
right.
goes faster.
And we've seen engaged employees are just better employees, so that's a good thing too.
The closing piece on that is a engaging manager produces engaged employees that deliver, depending on the business, either better customer loyalty, better service, better productivity, et cetera. That's not a new concept.
Right. Okay, well, unfortunately, I really only have time for one more question. The radio feed will actually literally cut us off in about 7 minutes. So I want to close with sort of from two different perspectives of this question, both from the point of view of an enterprise and from an individual. Let's say I've been listening and I'm really excited about this, and I think this is exciting, and I want to change either myself as a manager or as a CEO. I want to change the way I bring resources to management and help managers be better. Where do I start? How do we start to transform management and make it better?
Yeah. So first is in the identification of those people who really want to be managers. And that's not my expertise, by the way, in selection, but do know that it is done and done well. Let's choose the right talent, and that's talent that really is motivated or inspired by coaching and developing others. That's first. So let's get the right talent. And second is let's invest in that talent by giving them the right tools and skill set to lead others and do it well. And so I think the big call out I have for organizations today is that managers are either going to be your choke point or your acceleration point to the execution of your business strategy, to the success of your business. And they are the least invested in group in your organization today or in organizations today. Make the investment to build their skills and capabilities and make it a continuous investment, not a one-time onboarding.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being here, Gary. I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm really looking forward to it being in the archives for the next few months. I think anybody who didn't get to catch it live is really going to enjoy this conversation. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, if you don't know who that was Gary Magenta. He's the author of The Unbossy Boss, 12 Powerful Questions to Make You a Better Manager. I really suggest you read this book. I really think it's one of the best books in the last few years when it comes to management. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for Gary this week. We're taking next week off because it's a Memorial Day week, and let's face it, a bunch of you are going to be on vacation. I'm not going to try to get you here. We'll be back in 2 weeks, however, with Chris Duggan. Chris is the CEO and founder of BetterWorks. Chris and I are going to be talking about how managers and enterprises can give better feedback. Anyone who's gone through an annual review is probably going to want to tune into this one. That's Wednesday, June 3rd at 3 p.m. Eastern. Now, that just leaves me to thank everyone for tuning in to today's show. We couldn't do this without you, and it would be rather silly for us to try. So please come back every Wednesday, except next Wednesday, of course, at 3 p.m. Eastern for another great IT Life radio show. Remember, this is your IT Life. The rest of us are just paying rent.